Hello, welcome along to this week's episode of the Let's Get Running podcast. Thanks again for joining us. We're entering another busy period in the world of running. We're starting the UK cross-country season very shortly. It's obviously the autumn marathon season. We just had the Berlin Marathon with Bekele running rather well to beat Wilson Kipsang last weekend. I'm personally training for the Amsterdam Marathon in a couple of weeks' time, and things are going all right, touch wood. Now, this week's interview is with Renee McGregor, and she's a dietitian who's worked with a number of top endurance runners, including Holly Rush, who is our first interviewee. She's an ultramarathon runner, and also Ali Dixon, who is a British representative at Rio in the marathon this year. We talked to Renee about various things, including her experience at the Paralympic Games, her work as a dietitian, and we'll give a few tidbits on diets for endurance athletes. Here we go.
You're a dietitian as opposed to a nutritionist.
Yes.
Essentially, what's the difference?
So the major difference is that the term nutritionist is not protected. So anybody can call themselves a nutritionist. So you can do a PT course, like a personal trainer course, where they have an element of nutrition. You could do a diploma that's like 6 weeks long. And anybody who does that can call themselves a nutritionist. So I did a talk to British Gymnastics yesterday, to the coaches, and I said to them, potentially after this talk, if you wanted to, you could call yourselves a nutritionist because it's not protected. So that's, for me, that's a real issue, which is one of the reasons I haven't gone down the road of calling myself a nutritionist. I can do, because obviously I'm a dietitian, but I've almost tried to maintain dietitian because it's a protected term. So what it means is that it means, one, I've studied to a level of qualification that allows me to be a registered dietitian. Secondly, I have to work to a code of conduct. So I can't just make up something. I can't say to you, Sean, you must eat goji berries because they're going to make you run faster, even though I might think that. I can't say that to you. I have to find the evidence and the proof to say this is what you need to do because of A, B, and C. But again, with that, internet the way it is, we can pretty much find evidence for whatever we want to hear. So again, it's using a credible source and making sure the study is credible and accurate and actually reliable. I would always suggest to people to work with a dietitian. You can get registered nutritionists. Say that I don't want to taint all nutritionists with the same brush, because you can get registered nutritionists that work in sport or work in public health who are really very good. It's just harder to know if you've got one of those or whether you've got somebody who's just done a diploma and that's it. So it's quite a tricky one.
And how did you originally get into it?
So I did a biochemistry degree because I've always found the body really fascinating. Like, I've always enjoyed knowing what's going on at a cellular level. And I went off to do a biochemistry degree. And as my degree evolved, we could choose modules. And so I chose biochemistry, nutrition and physiology, and ended up with a nutritional biochemistry degree at the end of it. I had a really good mentor at university. He was really helpful. And I said, look, I don't know what to do with this because I don't really want to end up in a lab. I'm not ready for research. You know, I'm, 21 years old. I don't want to be in a lab. It doesn't interest me at the moment.
Yeah.
And he said, no, I think you're really suited to working in the public and working with people. You should maybe have a look. And at that point, and we're talking quite a long time ago, I'm 40, so we're talking a while ago. At that point, there wasn't much about sports nutrition. It was very much about dietetics and dietitians and working in the clinical field and potentially working in the community. So I decided to do a postgrad in dietetics, and that was a 2-year course. That was brilliant. I loved it, and I got loads from doing that, and I became a clinical dietitian, and I worked in the clinical field for about 5 years in total over a range of different clinical areas, and then I ended up settling around pediatrics and eating disorders, so I did that for quite a long time. And then in 2003, I had my first daughter, and so I guess I had her, and then, 22 months later, I had my second daughter. And there's something about having children that kind of makes you stop and take stock of what you want to do and what you want to achieve. And I did go back to the NHS, but I found it quite hard working with quite sick people, like sick children and eating disorders. I found it very, very difficult. I found it very emotionally challenging being a mum to two small kids as well as doing that. And so I started to think about what excites me, what what makes me tick. And the sports nutrition stuff has always been around for me. It's always been something I've thought, well, I'll do. And when I first qualified, you had to go, the only place you could go and do a sports nutrition course was in Australia. And you had to go to the Australian Institute of Sport and do an intensive month course. And that was never going to happen because I didn't have the money all the time. Yeah. And then by the time I got to the stage where my daughters were around, suddenly there were lots of postgrads that you could do here in this country that led you to the same qualification of becoming a sports dietitian. So I decided I might as well use my time at home. And I, while they were little, I basically did a postgrad over a year. So it was quite hard going. I was writing essays at 2 a.m. and that kind of stuff. But you know, I loved the content. I loved it. And I knew that I was making the right decision. So it's the first time, and I guess I was in my mid-30s, and I finally thought, yeah, I found what's making me happy from a work perspective. But I think I always say I got lucky in that my first proper role in performance sport was supporting the rhythmic gymnast girls going into London because they got a home nation entry. I think the reason I did so well with that was because I had the eating disorder background, because I'd had the clinical background, because I then had the new sports stuff, I could tie those two things together. And it meant that those girls went into competition in a healthy state, but aesthetically how they needed to be in order to compete. It was a big challenge, but you know, I learned so much from that experience. And I think potentially from there, I haven't really looked back. From that point onwards, sport's a small world. When coaches start to get to know you and they get to know, oh, such and such, that practitioner works with that person and they achieve this, they contact you. So I think I've just been really fortunate that my work has spoken for itself.
Because you work with some high-profile people, aren't you? I mean, Derby County you work with, and you've just been away.
Yeah, I mean, so I finished working with Derby last season. I gave up last season. I decided that it was a lot of travelling, and I wanted to give my 100% commitment to the two Paralympic squads I was working with. So I've worked, leading up to the Games, I've worked with wheelchair basketball, men's and women's squad, and I've worked with wheelchair fencing. It literally has completely overtaken my life probably for the last 9 months, if I'm honest. Just the preparation, when you're working with two teams, the preparation leading up to it, and then the kind of emotional, I guess the emotional connection with the athletes, because you've worked with them for so long, so intensely, and then you go and watch them perform and they achieve their goals. And I can't put that into words. It's a bit like... I guess it's the same pride I feel when I watch my daughters do something, you know, it's that same sort of, okay, yeah, we've nailed it. It was brilliant to be out there with the team. It's really nice to be out there with the team and kind of everybody's helping each other out. It's almost like your roles change. So you go out there, like I went out there obviously with my nutrition head on, but actually I did everything. You know, I was moving gear, I was there to support the girls and the athletes, particularly the younger ones, if they needed a hug because they were missing home. Or you do everything. You just become that kind of surrogate parent in a way and just support them. And it's you get close because of that. And also just with the other team members, because they're all out there as well. And we've all left our families behind. And it's quite hard. It's a hard environment. You know, you're constantly working. We were working really long days and coming home sometimes and coming back to the apartments and thinking, God, because of the 4-hour difference, I was thinking, shit, I haven't spoken to my kids for 5 days. It's been quite an emotional roller coaster, but amazing at the same time.
And how did the guys get on?
So we got a medal in both the squads I was working with, so that's fantastic. Piers Gilliver, who I've done a lot of work with, the fencer, got silver, which was probably the best day of the competition for me, because I literally was there at 7 and there till 10 o'clock that evening and just watching him achieve each rung. And it was exactly like we'd simulated it. We'd done some simulation camps and stuff. So we talked about what it might feel like, what it might look like, what it might be like. And the only thing that we hadn't quite expected was that there was a 3-hour gap between the semi-final and the final. So it was really good that I was there in a way, because Pete, his lead coach, came out to me and said, right, Rena, we've got 3 hours. What do I get him to do now in order to make sure he's got the energy, because he's knackered, because he's just been competing all day. So it was really good because we had everything we needed. And I said, right, he needs one of these, one of these, one of these. and in this order and in this time. And that helped him. And although he got a silver, we always knew that the guy he was up against was going to be a challenge. So, you know, I'm really proud of him. He's achieved a medal and he's 22 years old. First Games, amazing experience for him.
And have you already signed up for Tokyo?
Yeah. I mean, I've just been on the phone to Pete because they're flying back tonight and they had the opening ceremony. And he's already thinking about 4-year cycle. I'm like, Pete, get home, chill out, and then we'll talk about the 4-year cycle. I'm like, I don't even know if I'm going to be part of the team going forward. We have to wait and see. The problem with sport is that you just never know what's going to happen. You never know what the funding's going to be and what they can afford and what they can't. And while we've worked really well as a team, I can't guarantee that I'll be kept on. It will depend on the PD's choice and the situation we're in and stuff. So we'll see. But yeah, it is exciting. And then the basketball guys got a bronze, so that was really exciting. And the basketball girls actually finished the highest they've ever finished in Olympic Games, so in a Paralympic Games, sorry. So really, really positive results for me from a personal practitioner point of view. Really, really positive. And to be able to go and watch them and support them was... It was just brilliant, just amazing environment and excitement. And I lost my voice while I was out there. I was screaming so much. So I've loved it. I cannot tell you how much I've enjoyed working with Paralympic sports. Like, people say, well, is it that different to, you know, to able-bodied sports? And it is. It's massively different because you've got to get a really good understanding of their disability and the potential clinical manifestations of that disability and what that might be. And you've got to think about what you're trying to achieve from an athlete point of view, like what body composition goals, what are the targets that the coach wants. And you've got to think about, okay, what are the limitations here then? It's not a case of do this, eat this, lift weights, you'll get the body composition you want. It's actually trying to understand what the limitations of their disability could be, but also giving them all the tools, enabling them to perform at their best. I think that's why I've really enjoyed it. And I can say that, you know, I've been working on 2 medal-winning programs, and it's a brilliant place to be in that respect.
And obviously you're working with some top runners too.
Yeah.
And you run yourself. When did you start?
When did I start running? So I started running when my second daughter was 1 year old. And I literally started running because I just wanted to get fit again. I'd had 2 children quite close together. And I've never been unfit, but I just wanted a bit of time for myself, I think. And it was difficult to go to classes or anything or the gym because of time commitments and stuff. So I just literally started. We were actually living on a canal boat at the time, so it was really easy to just jump off the canal boat, go for a 10-minute jog and then come back again. And that's how I started, by running for 10 minutes and coming back. And then I might go a bit further. And then I met some local runners who were running for Team Bath, and they said, oh, you must join the club, you know. They took me along to a race, actually. They said, come on, come along to this race. And I was thinking, I've never raced in my life. Why am I going to do this? So I went off to this cross-country race, and I finished 3rd female. And they were like, do you run? I was like, well, I do my own thing. I don't, you know. And they said, you must come and join the team. If you'd been in the team, you would have won the team prize. And this was all alien to me. I had no idea what they were talking about. They could have been talking a different language as far as I was concerned. And I was like, yeah, but I just like running because I enjoy it. It just makes me feel happy. And that's why I like running. You know, I don't really need to achieve as such. Yeah. But I did join the club. It's very difficult for me. I'm not an evening person. So a lot of the sessions were in the evening. I'm a definite morning person. So I did go and I did do some track sessions, but it wasn't great. But that's where I met Holly. That's how Holly and I met, because obviously she was running for Team Bath at the time and her husband Martin was coaching us all. And he had heard about me and he said, oh, actually, you know, Holly hasn't got any nutrition advice. She's got no nutritional support. What do you think? I really like the fact that you're a biochemist background as well. Do you fancy working with her? And I was like, yeah absolutely. So we started working together, god blimey, I'm trying to think now, back in 2010, I think. It was a long time ago. we've got a really good relationship. I mean, we became friends very quickly. I mean, we got on very, very well and became friends very, very quickly. But I think, again, that came from trust. She trusted what I was saying. And I took on board everything she would say to me and go, I'm not sure about this. I want to try this. Or I've read this. What do you think about this? And again, you have that relationship where you can be completely open and honest. And I think that's so important when you're working with people.
And how often do you guys catch up then in that relationship? Do you speak fairly regularly with each other?
we speak all the time now because we're good friends. But when we first started working together, we'd meet up probably every couple of weeks just to see. And particularly leading into a marathon at the time, she was still doing marathons then, we would talk a lot about, well, how did that training go? What did you do? Did that work? Because I was getting to know her. I needed to know her body. I needed to know how it responded. And then going into Houston, she sent me her training, and so I would then give her advice according to her training on a weekly basis, and then we did the plan, the race strategy, and that worked for her. I mean, she basically finished 2 seconds off her PB, but she hadn't been able to achieve that time for quite a few years, so she was really chuffed that she'd done it. So, and I guess we've been working for such a long time now, she knows what she needs to do. She still runs ideas. She still runs, like when she did the CCC last month, she messaged me. She goes, I know you're really, really busy and I know you're in holding camp, but please, can you just tell me what I should do? And it's like, yeah, that's fine. And, you know, you just go run through stuff and so it's good because she understands the basics and she understands what she needs to do. But I think it's just that reiteration that Rini said, do this. And it's things like, what changed? Like, so for CCC, we knew it was going to be really, really hot. So we looked at salt and how you change that. So where she normally has one SCAP an hour, I said, actually, I think you might need to have two or even three because it's going to be that hot, you know. And it's, again, it's understanding how her body works. I've run with her as well lots of times, so I know in a way what her sweat losses are like because you've spent time with her. So I can say, you know, I've noticed this, or I can say to her, I noticed you didn't drink anything there, or you didn't eat anything there, and that's why you felt like that. Or,
yeah.
To be fair to her, equally, she nags me just as much. So it's quite funny. She does it. Have you eaten? Yes, I've eaten, Mum. You know, that kind of stuff. But I still give her nutrition, but she's probably more now a really close friend than an athlete, you know, than I work with. So. So working with her, working with Robbie Britton, working with Ali Dixon, sort of going into Rio, which was really exciting again for her. And she, you know, again, she's a very disciplined athlete. She kind of knew what she was doing. Her downfall was recovery. And she found that through working with me and getting that recovery right, her training was so consistent. And that's what translated when she was out in Rio. You know, she had a stormer of a race, considering how hot it was and the expectations on her work. So I've been really lucky that I've got to work with some amazing people, and they're just fun to work with. I just love it, you know.
In terms of adapting a plan with different athletes, do you put them through sort of various testing procedures, or is it more about the feedback from how they feel and how they perform?
No, it's a mixture of lots of different things. I mean, I think there are many, many practitioners out there that approach working with athletes in a bit of a, here's a sheet, off you go. You know, this works for somebody else, it's going to work for you. I see every single person I work with as an individual, and I need to get to know them before I can say, do you know what, I don't think that's going to work for you. Let's try this, or let's do this. And I will keep at it until I know we get it right. And so, with some of the younger athletes, I've had to try different types of approaches to get them to really buy into what I'm saying. That's such an important feature of a practitioner, is developing that trust between you and the coach and you and the athlete. Usually, if you're working with the coaches and the S&C coaches, you kind of work together as a team and you're looking at specific things. So we'll look at speed, we'll look at grip strength, and particularly in the Paralympic sports, we'll look at body composition. I think you also have to sometimes sit down with the team and go, okay, what are we trying to achieve here? I've just been really lucky to work with two brilliant teams that have allowed me to put my thoughts forward, but also have been really supportive when I've gone, I'm not sure about this. What do you think? What else can we do? So when we were working with Piers going into Rio, one of the things I discussed with his coach quite a lot was, what are we going to do to get him ready? Do we want to do altitude? Is that going to work for his sport? Probably not. We discussed it with a physiologist. It's not going to work. And in fact, she suggested that perhaps heat acclimatization would be better than anything else from an adaptive point of view. So we did a lot of heat acclimatizing. And literally, they fenced in a bedroom with a radiator on. Yeah. I honestly think that had a massive impact on his performance last week, because he was used to performing in the heat, and he built up that tolerance, and his, you know, perceived exertion in the heat improved as the 10 days went on. Like, I'll check their bloods quite regularly, looking at, you know, things like vitamin D, iron, C-reactive protein, thyroid function, because all those give me an idea of what's going on in the body. How's their immune function? Are we overtraining them? Do they need a rest? All those things, they make sense to me. So that's kind of how I build a picture, and then I give them advice.
We runners we're a strange bunch, and I don't know whether as a sport we're predisposed, is that the right word, to perhaps going too far with eating and maybe disordered eating. Mm. Is that something you've seen in your experience?
I was thinking about this question. I've been thinking about it a lot, because I've just been looking at my workload for the next few weeks, and majority of the requests that have come in are runners with eating problems. And
right.
So what I was questioning is, are they coming to me because they see me as the expert of someone who works with runners with eating problems, or are they coming to me because it's a real problem? And I think I can't give you the answer to that one. I think it is a problem. I think it's a big concern, and I agree. I mean, running is quite obsessive, as we all know.
Yeah.
And I think having a good attitude towards running is quite a difficult thing to achieve. I'd like to think I've achieved it. Like, you know, I didn't run for a week in Rio. Didn't run. There's not much I can do about it. I missed it, but just the way it was. Whereas I do know people that would really struggle with that. They would go nuts. You know, and it's a difficult one, because you've got that old school, very much old school thinking of the lighter you are, the faster you're going to run. And that tends to have that tends to be the starting point, you know, that, well, if I'm a bit lighter, maybe I'll run a bit faster. And the problem is that when you do drop a few kilos, you do find that your PBs improve and stuff to begin with. It's knowing when that's enough and actually when that becomes detrimental. But I guess I don't want to dumb down the illness of an eating disorder, because it's a very, very complicated mental illness. And I think sometimes it's hard to kind of distinguish, does the running cause the eating disorder, or actually is the eating disorder there predisposed and the running kind of aids it because of the nature of what you're doing with running? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, obviously I work with an eating disorder charity as well, and it's a very sad and very, very complicated mental illness. And a lot of it is to do with control of anxiety, control of emotions, not wanting to feel is a way I would describe it. Is, you know, for whatever reason, it could have been a traumatic event in their life when they were younger. It's like their experience of that event, whether it was bullying, whether it was abuse, whether it was just the way they interpreted their parents' love or whatever. You know, it's so complicated. It's their experience and it's their inability to like themselves. And so in order to cope with that, in order to kind of protect themselves from feeling like that, they want control. And running is a great way of getting control, as we know. You know, you go out, you have a run, you forget about your worries, you come back, and you feel better about yourself. You know, it's a great endorphin booster as well. But if you don't fuel it correctly, you don't get the adaptation. And that's the one thing I would say to all athletes, is that, you know, being thinner doesn't necessarily make you a better runner. And a lot of athletes say to me, yeah, but I'm not, you know, I'm eating this and I'm not losing any weight, so why should I eat what you're saying? And it's because actually once the body gets into that energy deficiency and it really struggles, it's trying to preserve as much energy as possible, and so it actually slows everything down. The body always will always kind of preferentiate locomotion over anything else, so it will shut everything else down. So that's why women stop menstruating, you know, that's why sometimes you feel cold all the time, that's why your concentration goes, You know, these are the things, the body starts to shut down in order to allow for locomotion to happen because it has to. And so it does slow things right down. And so you could have an athlete who's running loads, hardly eating anything, and saying, yeah, but I'm not losing any weight. And it's like, yeah, but actually, if you eat more, you're still not going to put weight on because the body will utilize that energy for all these things that it needs to do. So it's a very, it's a very simplistic way of looking at it. It's a very, very complex condition. And I've worked with so many athletes, elite and non-elite, triathletes, runners, you name it, with eating problems. I think it's a big issue. And I think a lot of it comes from society in a way. I have to be really careful about what I say about this because people jump down your throat when you say that. But I think what I mean by that is if you're somebody who's quite vulnerable, if you're somebody who struggles with their sense of self, and yeah, you're bombarded by images of aesthetically pleasing people or even image of what life should look like, you know, like we have all these bloggers, we have Joe Wicks, we have Deliciously Ella, we have Fern Cotton, we have all these people who are selling a lifestyle. You know, they are beautiful people, they always will be. That's how they were born, genetically.
Yes.
It's not what they eat or how they live their lives that makes them, gives them that image. They will always be that person. And I think sometimes when you're feeling down on yourself, you'll look at them and think, if I do that, maybe I'll look like that. Maybe my life will become like that. And I think it's really dangerous. And as a mum to teenagers, it scares the life out of me because, you know, I see my girls sometimes looking at those images and thinking, oh, I'm not good enough. And I always tell my girls every single day that they're beautiful. And actually, they don't need to worry about whether they've got blonde hair or blue eyes or perfect long legs or whatever. You know, it's about them being who they are that's more important. Yeah. And actually, when I work with athletes, it's the same thing. Sometimes I take on that role of, do you know what? Does it matter? If you're happy with you, does it matter? It's one number. Yeah. It's a number. Why allow a number to dictate who you are? Because that's what you're looking at. It doesn't change you. And it's about getting to know you and getting to like you. And that is the brunt of helping anybody with an eating disorder, is actually being, they have to learn to be comfortable with their sense of self. So yeah, that's a long-winded answer to
And even for guys that perhaps don't have maybe disordered eating, do you tend to see common mistakes amongst runners who come to you? What's the main thing, problem?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple. So one of the ones I see quite a lot of is people thinking they can eat whatever they want because they're running 80 miles a week or 60 miles a week or whatever. And I think it's a difficult one because obviously everybody's individual and some people can probably eat whatever they want and run 60 miles a week. But actually not everybody's body responds that way. Will you get the best from your running if you eat whatever you want? Probably not. And that's kind of what I always say to people is it's not necessarily about the quantity of food. It's about the quality of food. It's about making sure you're choosing the right building blocks to ensure you can hit those paces or hit those times so that your body can progress and adapt in the way it needs to. But it's also about getting the recovery in. It's about having rest. It's about having sleep. It's about, you know, being hydrated, all those different things. So I'd say common mistakes tend to be those really that, and I say this in the books as well, is that I think people know they need to eat carbs to perform and protein to recover. But it's really not as simple as that. You know, it's about knowing how many grams of carbs you might need. What do I need if I'm doing this type of session? And what do I need if I'm recovering from this? And I think it is something that people probably need to pay a bit more attention to if they want to do well. If you are somebody who just wants to run because you enjoy running and actually that's all it's about, it's not about achieving a time or a body composition goal or whatever, then go for your life. Enjoy it. You know, that's my attitude. But if you're somebody who wants to achieve a number or a time or whatever, then actually you probably need to pay a bit more attention.
And one of the questions I put the post out on Twitter to see if it had any specific questions. The one I got back was about kind of low carbohydrate diets.
You're going to ask me that one. I've asked that so many times in the last year. It's unbelievable. So there's a real trend to follow a low-carb, high-fat diet at the moment, particularly in ultra-runners. And I guess what I want to say is that potentially from a performance point of view, having a slightly lower-carb diet and a not necessarily higher fat, but slightly lower carb diet at certain times of your training can be beneficial because obviously upregulates your ability to use fat for fuel. If you're doing it from a weight loss point of view, forget it, because it doesn't work from a weight loss point of view. So all you do is when you remove carbohydrate from your diet, all you do is you remove your glycogen stores, which is also where you store fluid. You know, for every gram of glycogen you hold in your muscle stores, you also hold up to 4 grams of water. So, you know, when people go on these Atkin diets and paleo diets and weird diets where they remove carbs from their diet and they lose like a stone in the first week, a lot of that is actually fluid. It's not proper body fat. And then they struggle, then they start to slow down and they wonder why. So they cut down even further and they cut down even further. And then you get that awful negative cycle where you're actually in an energy deficit and the body's going, well, hang on a minute, I haven't got enough to perform, and you start to feel rubbish. So I think if you're looking at it from a performance point of view, then there are times when I would suggest that you do a carb depleted run. I would never, ever, ever take carbs out of your diet, ever, because there's a lot of evidence that says if you take carbs out of your diet completely, actually you put your immune system under a huge amount of stress. And that can lead to overtraining, overreaching, and also potential autoimmune illnesses, you know. And I've seen that a lot in clinic. So I've not done a study on it, but observationally, I've probably had half a dozen to a dozen athletes come into clinic over the last year who've gone low carb, high fat, and actually ended up in a real mess and not been able to perform. What we know from science is that if you want to perform at a higher intensity, the only way you will do that is if you've got carbohydrate in your system. So while you can run on fat alone, you won't run the fast times that you want to. People say to me, "Oh, well, I've had loads of PBs since I've been doing low carb, high fat." Great if that works for you, but it doesn't necessarily mean that if you didn't then put carbs back in, you wouldn't be able to run faster. You won't know unless you try. And the other thing I want to distinguish here is there's a real difference between ketogenic, which is the very low carb, where you only eat 50 grams of carbohydrate, which is really quite detrimental, particularly for females, because it really interferes with estrogen production, so bone health. And then a lower carb diet, which is around sort of 150, 180 grams of carbs a day. Now, that's okay. Most people can cope on that, particularly if you're a recreational runner. Actually, that's probably enough for you. That's not necessarily a very low-carb diet. And I think people are getting very confused about what a low-carb diet is, what a ketogenic diet is. And so I would never, ever advocate a ketogenic diet. But I would advocate a lower carb diet, particularly if you're doing a lot of your running at lower intensities, or if you're training for an ultra and you are trying to improve your ability to use more fat for fuel. But if you cut carbs out completely, the problem you have is when you go into a race and you want to use carbohydrate, you've downregulated your ability to utilize carbohydrate for fuel. And that's when people end up with problems with stomach issues and the inability to use the carbohydrate, but it is the carbohydrate that's going to get you through the race. So when I talk about periodization, what I talk about is, so some people say periodization over training plans, like this is a high volume training block, so we're going to do this. This is a low volume training block, so we're going to do this. I actually talk about periodization on a daily basis. So, you know, if you've got an athlete, you'll look at their week schedule, and they've got maybe two high quality sessions in there that they're going to do some speed stuff or hills or whatever, intervals. So I know from that point of view, in order for them to nail that, in order for them to smash those times and actually get the adaptation from that, they need carbohydrate in their system. So in the 24 hours leading up to those sessions, we'll include carbohydrate and also for the recovery afterwards. If they're doing some lower intensity stuff, so some longer type runs where they're running at, say, 60% of their max and up to, say, 2 hours, I'd say to them, do you know what? Try that in a fasted state. See how you get on. So maybe in the morning when you're in a carb-depleted state. So I never, ever would advocate removing carbs completely, but I think you can be clever with your carbs and you can know when to put them in, how. And the other thing is knowing to put the right carbs in. Because I think, again, one of the reasons people, carbs get such a bad press is because it's very easy to overconsume the wrong types of carbs. So the example I always use is if I was to give you a packet of Jelly Babies, you could probably finish that in 10 minutes flat, no problems, easy. And if you'd consumed the whole bag of Jelly Babies, you would have consumed 150 grams of carbohydrate. Right. I would have to give you the equivalent of 3 jacket potatoes to consume the same amount of carbohydrate. It's a lot harder to do. So that's the difference, is that actually if you eat the right types of carbohydrates, you eat the nutrient-dense carbohydrates like your whole grains, like your oats, like your sweet potatoes, your rye breads, that kind of stuff. Those slow release complex carbohydrates that take a long time to kind of release energy through the day. Actually, you can have carbs throughout the day, but it's just knowing the portion sizes depending on the training you're doing and also the quality of the carbs.
And with periodization, so would you look at it on a kind of a season spectrum?
I guess it depends on who I'm working with, if I'm honest. So at the moment, I've got quite a lot of triathletes and marathon runners who are gearing up for the autumn races and autumn. And so actually what we do is we look at their training plan on a weekly basis and we tailor it according to their week. Right. Post-running, so with Holly, she finished CCC, so she'll have and Robbie did CCC as well. They'll have a down period of a month where I'll just let them do what they want. It's their call. They can just, you know, if they want to eat chips, that's their thing. If they want to eat ice cream, that's their thing. I think it's really important for the body to be able to go back to almost a slightly heavier point, because actually that's good for the body in terms of making sure that they have enough energy for things like menstruation to continue, for body to repair itself, that kind of stuff. So usually I give people time off, and then when we start building up the next race, we'll start again, you know. So, but I do tend to do things on a weekly basis rather than a rotational, if that makes sense, generally. But that's just been the way I've worked because of the athletes I've worked with more than anything else.
And is there any kind of research developments in the last few months?
There's lots going on. A lot of work is being done into bone health. A lot of work is being done into vitamin D. A lot of work is being done into this whole fat versus carbs. But at the moment, all the results that are coming through are pretty much standard, that if you want to perform at a high intensity, you still need carbohydrate in your system. Vitamin D is a really interesting nutrient from a sports nutrition point of view. We're finding it's linked to so many things, like seems to be linked to skeletal muscle recovery. So if you've got somebody who's in a high volume training block, you probably find actually upping their intake of vitamin D is really important, because it will drain quite quickly. So that's quite an important one. And then I think looking at other sort of, there's always a lot of looking into particular nutrients like tart cherry juice, like beetroot. And the studies are always a little bit kind of varied with the results. So again, you read quite a few of them and then you make a decision. I mean, I do encourage people to use tart cherry juice if they're doing a lot of high volume stuff, because there does seem to be a lot of evidence to suggest that it can help prevent that kind of oxidative damage, particularly after high intensity training. So I do recommend things like that. When it comes to recovery, I'm still a real fan of using just milk for recovery. I think milk's brilliant. It helps you hydrate, it gives you electrolytes back, it gives you carbs, it gives you protein. I mean, I think you can make sports nutrition really complicated, and sometimes I think practitioners do make it complicated because they want to look good, like they want to look like they're scientists. Actually, if something works, stick with it.
I can't remember where it was. I think it was on some podcast ago, and they said things that have been around for a long time are generally fine to eat. So, like, you know, water and milk and stuff. We've been using these things for generations. Yeah, so
exactly.
Yeah. Anything that comes out of the ground has been,
And I think that's my general ethos about nutrition and sports nutrition is, you know, you don't have to buy expensive ingredients. You don't have to buy sports products. Try and keep things real, you know. I use a lot of frozen fruit and veg because it's a really good way of making sure that the nutrient content stays quite high. You know, if I buy a load of veg and then I don't use it for several days because I'm busy, then by the time I've cooked it, I'm probably not getting quite as much nutrients from it. Whereas if I use frozen, then I know that it's there from the moment I, you know, start cooking with it. I always, always try and cook from scratch if I can, but I don't beat myself up if I have to use a jar of pasta sauce or, you know, one of those ready-made soups or whatever, because life is short. And when you're busy, sometimes you just have to help. You just have to help. So I don't think convenience food is that real negative that people are making it out to be. I mean, I'm not going to say you should live on it all the time, but I think, you know, we do seem to be going from extreme to extreme, and people demonize things, and then once they've demonized it, it becomes a no-no, it becomes a taboo. And I think that scares me, because again, that then feeds back into that whole disordered eating and orthorexia and all those worries that, well, if I eat that, something awful's going to happen. Yeah. I told you earlier I had to eat peanut M&Ms in Rio. That happened to me, you know, it's
you're still
I'm
here.
Still here. Yeah. I'm still smiling and I'm still talking. So, you know, I think it's about putting things into perspective sometimes, and actually having quite a relaxed attitude is probably the best attitude when it comes to food.
Yeah. And kind of this information, well, I've had bits of this information in the two books you've just got coming out.
Yes.
What's the name of the two books?
So we've got Fast Fuel for Runners and Fast Fuel for Triathlon. So triathletes. So they kind of, so, you know, training food was the big one that had everything in it and loads of different sports. And there seemed to be quite a lot of demand from athletes who they wanted a book for themselves. And I was like, okay, fair enough. So it's been great because it's meant I've actually been able to include a lot more information for runners in the running book and a lot more information for triathletes in the triathlon book that they can take away and use according to their training programs. So I really hope, I mean, they come out on October the 20th, so I really hope that people enjoy them and like them. I'm really proud of them. I feel like I'm really happy with them. But, you know, the proof's in the pudding, so we'll see.
Yeah. And where's the best place to pick those up?
You can buy them on Amazon now, so you can pre-order them on Amazon if you want to. And then they usually, I mean, I found with training food, people were telling me that they were sending me pictures. Oh, look what I found in Waterstones in Kent or whatever. So I think Waterstones will probably also keep them. Most bookstores, most independent bookstores probably will. But Amazon seems to be the place that most people can get them from.
And to finish off the interview, I've got three questions. I try and ask everybody I interview on the podcast. And the first is, if you could recommend one make or model of running shoe.
Oh, blimey.
Or to wear, that would be the only one you'd ever wear again. Which would it be?
Oh, that's a really tough one, because I've kind of worked my way through quite a few. I'll be honest, I'd always go back to Innovates. Always. But yeah. I do mainly trail running, so I think that's probably why. But I do tend to go back to Innovates.
Perfect. Any particular model or just?
I'm loving the Mudclaw at the moment because I'm a bit of a wuss going downhill, so Mudclaw gives me a bit more confidence. So yeah.
Perfect. And have you got a recommended book, magazine, or basically a recommended read or recommended watch you can share with us?
I'll be honest, I'm not. I think books can be inspiring. I've not read any book by a runner that I've thought, wow. And I'm going to say that really, like, I think they're interesting, but have I learned anything from it? Not really. But I think the most inspiring thing I have watched recently, and it really, really inspired me and actually really hit a chord, was the film Mira. By the Nepalese runner, about the Nepalese runner. And I think because I've been to Nepal and I've got a really special place for Nepal in my heart, and I think she's incredible, what she's been through and what she's achieved. So I'd probably say I'd rather watch Mira than recommend a book.
And the final one, in your opinion, what's the greatest endurance, you can do just endurance rather than running, endurance performance of all time?
Oh God, again, that's really hard because there are so many amazing things that people achieve. I think, and I am going to take it to running because I think I need to narrow it down, otherwise I'll just be here all day. And this may sound a little bit biased because I work with them, But when you work with someone and you invest that time in them and you know the heartache they've been through to get to that start line, to me, when they've achieved what they've set out to achieve and you know all the journey they've been through, for me, that would be what I would want to talk about. And it does have to go to Holly, because on so many occasions, having been by her side for the last 6 years and watch her achieve things like Comrade, CCC, Ultrarasen, but I know that journey and that pain she's been through. Like, sometimes the journey leading up to the start has not been good. She's been injured, she's been ill, she's been, you know, she's had personal family issues, whatever. And I think because you know that person, you're rooting for them. Yeah. How she continues to inspire every race she does. So without sounding too much like an emotional emotional practitioner, I'd say probably for me it has to be, yeah, watching Holly cross Comrades was a real moment, if I'm honest.
I was going to ask you that. How does it feel watching these?
I'm an absolute wreck. I mean, God, you should have seen me in Rio last week when I was watching Piers compete for the silver medal. I mean, I was sat next to his brother, and you know, I don't know Miles very well, but we got to know each other very well that day because we were both stood there like shouting and screaming at Piers, and like, and we were shaking. And when Piers won the semi-final and we knew he was going into the gold medal last fight, we knew we'd won a medal, so we knew it was going to be gold or silver. And I think we were like, my heart was racing. And I took the video, actually. I did the video analysis for those. I dread to think when they look back on the video, because all they'll hear is me screaming my head off. And I did say to Pete, the coach, said, I apologise, but I think all you'll hear is me in the video. I mean, I love watching them, and I love seeing them achieve their goals. And but it is nerve-wracking, I'm not going to lie to you. I get very nervous when my athletes compete.
Perfect. Nice one. Well, thank you very much.
No worries. Good. I hope I haven't rambled too much. I'm quite
It's all been good stuff, so I'm sure they'll get a lot from it.
Cool.
Nice one. Thank you very much.
All right, take care then. Bye.